Hey, I'm Eric Tornberg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's guest is Chris Schroeder. Chris is a successful founder, investor, and now author of a book called Startup Rising, the entrepreneurial revolution that's remaking the Middle East, which chronicles startups in Cairo, Gaza, Damascus, and other cities. He's one of the most interesting guys I've met this year, and in this episode we discuss the Middle East, the role governments play in innovation, the intersection between tech and politics in Washington, where Chris lives, the future of cities and human population, and a lot more. It's a very wide-ranging conversation. All right, here's Chris. Startup Rising. Why this book? Why now?
Look, I've been running companies for 12 years, and I've outsourced technology across pretty much any emerging market you can imagine. And in parallel to that, my whole life has been comprised of thinking about our place in the world. And the Middle East has been a big part of that. But I've never squared the two. I've never had an ability to understand that everything I've seen, when ubiquitous access of technology happens in other emerging markets, could possibly be happening in a place when we see on the news is constantly in turmoil and conflict, meaning the Middle East. 3.5, 4 years ago, I was invited by some friends to speak at the first gathering of startups in the Middle East. And I went there completely kicking and screaming.
Where was this?
It was in Dubai. And I thought, you know, this is good guys, could be interesting, but no way Mubarak's Egypt at that time could be kicking up the ecosystems I'd seen in India and Sri Lanka and Eastern Europe and South America and Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And literally within 2 hours of being there, I realized that my worldview of the region and the world was going to be judged before that event and after that event. 3,000 young people from all over the Arab world doing all the things you and I take for granted. 3,000 person waiting lists of the same. And it sort of hit me more than anything else at a personal level of my narrative bias. I mean, I've been to 50 countries. As I say, I've outsourced technology everywhere. But I had such one story about the Middle East. It had not conceived to me of that which was happening everywhere was happening now in the Middle East. And that began a journey not only of exploring it, but then led me to want to write this book.
And, you know, you're not just going to Dubai. You're also going to Gaza. You're going to Iran. You're going all over. Take me from this trip to Dubai to the rest of the Middle East as well.
So what I saw in Dubai was comprised of young people from all over the region. So what I ended up doing was extending that trip. So I went to Jordan and Egypt to see more of the same. And I wanted to really check it out, whether this was a one-off or something bigger. And everything I saw was confirming of that. But I think in many respects, the turning point was I got invited back to be a judge at a startup competition in Cairo in January of 2011. And for those who don't remember the dates, two things happened. The week I was there, Ben Ali of Tunisia left the country. And everyone in Egypt told me it could never happen in Egypt. And a week later, every entrepreneur I was dealing with was in Tahrir Square and everything began to change in a very powerful way. So it was a hit to me that this is happening at something at scale that crosses many aspects of people's lives. And if it's happening here, it can happen anywhere. So what ended up happening is I was running a company called HealthCentral.com. It was an American-based company, not very global, so I had to stay focused on that. But periodically, I'd get invitations back to judge or mentor and whatever. And when I could, I would take vacation time to do it. And it just became, just a success breeds success. The more I saw, the more that I wanted to see. And the more I saw there, I then saw in Turkey, and then I saw it in other parts of South America and Africa. And then when things began to open up in Iran, I was invited to come with some business people as a tourist, but to explore it. And as you can imagine, I spent a lot of time with the startups, saw it all again. And it's now become a very important part of my view of where the world is going.
So, you know, Red Startup Rising chronicles the entrepreneurial revolution in the Middle East. What's next for you there?
So half of my life is spent with American startups, and that's very important to me, both investing in them and mentoring and helping them. But it's been kind of a nonprofit part of my life where I've become a mentor and also something of a bridge, I think, to Silicon Valley and to a lesser degree New York to connect young entrepreneurs and to just get, in almost a passionate way, people thinking about what this world is going to look like, because this will happen, right? What will this world look like when 2/3, 70%, 80% of humanity is walking around with a smart device, is walking around with a supercomputer in their pocket? What might that mean, both opportunities here and for these rising economies in places that we typically write them off because of our narrative bias? At the moment, that half of my life is really a nonprofit. I just help people. I get invited over there. I connect folks. I'm on the board of the American University of Cairo's Business School. I'm on the board of the American University of Beirut, and that's part of it. But I'm now beginning to explore other ways that I could be helpful, particularly in investment and finance there.
Is your thesis similar to Dave McClure's in that there are a lot of opportunities?
I'm a huge admirer of Dave's for this, and he and I, in fact, traveled together many times in this. He tends to be very, very early investment. I tend to be sort of at the end of his tip and then A, B, C round in my thinking. But I think we completely share what are the ramifications of universal access to super technology and rising middle classes and a whole new generation literally raised without the presumptions that Dave and I sort of were raised with when we were kids about where the world was going. These are folks who look around at their parents and effectively say, I'm going to wait a generation to fix education. Like, you just wrote off my generation. So guess what? I'm going to come up with a great mobile application to help education right now. You think pollution takes governments years to fix? Well, I got a whole bunch of different ideas about how I can use technology in very powerful ways to do that. You think traffic in Cairo is terrible? Well, I'm going to create a ways at like capability so people can navigate traffic. This is a whole generation, I think, globally now, not just it's you take it for granted in Silicon Valley, but it's a global phenomenon where people are saying almost every problem could be a software problem. And now I have the ability to see anybody else. I can be inspired by anybody else. I can collaborate with anybody else. I can take best practices there and bring them to bear here with my own innovation. And I think as importantly, and I think Dave really has picked up on this as well, there's this a massive sense of empowerment. Because if, in fact, you see people like you do things and it works, then you can think. Whereas 10 years ago, I think a lot of people in the world looked around and said, well, this can't happen here. And people just aren't saying that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think Dave is putting his money where his mouth is, and he's on a plane 20 times a year, and it's why I'm doing some of the same things in a different area.
But still, you know, I'm sure many of your Silicon Valley friends and ours aren't. What's the holdup? What are they going to need to see?
Look, one of the things that you see when you travel around the world in many different places is that for all the cliche and hoopla and even demagoguery that comes with places like Silicon Valley, it is really one of the most extraordinary places actually in world history. I mean, maybe Florence in the 1500s. Wow. I mean, the network effect of talent here is just so unbelievable. And the system of rule and law and other things that have allowed this kind of innovation to happen is very unique. And so you look at it and you say, this is an incredible place to be. And there's amazing opportunity here. And so if you're a very successful venture capitalist, or if you're a young person starting your company, you want to be among the best of the best. And so that's the good part of it.
Yep. Right?
I think the lesser part of it is, again, narrative bias. It's amazing to me, when I wrote this book, I interviewed some of the best in Silicon Valley, and they were looking at global expansion through a lens of maybe the last 10 years, which is, look, if that region is big enough, you know, I may lose my ass in China, but I've got to be there because it's big. Me. If I can go over here and I can outsource something cheaper, I'll do that. Me. All of a sudden, people are starting to say, maybe that's not the way to think of the future. Because if the theory is right, that these economies are rising and millions of young people are coming involved and engaging, then you start to essay two things. Not only is there a great market there, but there's going to be great insight there. A conventional Silicon Valley answer is, well, if they're that good, they'll come to Silicon Valley. That's fine. At the same time, there are going to be a lot of people who don't. And I think very slowly people are starting to say, okay, maybe there are new ways to engage. Not me, but in co-authorship. In a way, they are going to bring something to the table, we're going to bring something to the table. Technology allows borders to break in many different ways. Let's think about it differently. One last observation. I could be wrong. I can't prove this to you. I actually think Alibaba has been a wake-up call for some of the more sophisticated sisters and brothers you and I have out here in the Valley. Because remember, it is the largest IPO in world history whose business was fundamentally not built with the West at all. Mm-hmm. Even in the hardware days in gaming and electronics, when Japan and Korea rose, they rose because they had to depend on our markets and our technology. That was not the case with Alibaba. And I think we're going to see more and more companies like that, who, by the way, do want to engage here, but they don't have to. Mm-hmm. And I think the smarter people here in the Valley are beginning to understand that.
And so top, you know, entrepreneurs and investors and people in tech and in the Valley, you want them to read the book and walk away with what?
I think that there are maybe two things. One is a personal level and one is from a business or co-authorship level. I think the personal level is that a lot of people tend to look at the world in bucket or way. And they'll look at places like the Middle East, and they'll look at places like Africa, and say, there's one narrative there, it's all messed up, I'm going to ignore it, and there can be nothing that can happen there. All of a sudden, people can look at this and see complete familiarity, have the same moment that I had, which is, of course, it's happening there, because it's happening everywhere. And by the way, we have people who come to Silicon Valley from all over the world, they're all rock stars, so we know that this is a global phenomenon. It's an awareness of questioning the typical narratives that we see in the news, whether it's we're seeing it online or in traditional CNN sense or whatever. But secondly, and I think this is very important, I think there's an amazing opportunity for a new kind of dialogue, which in fact is essential over time for the way that our country can engage with other parts of the world in this co-authorship of innovation and problem solving, because it raises everybody's boats. This isn't just about Silicon Valley helping other places, because that's where they lose. I mean, how many friends do you and I have who went into emerging markets and thought when they arrived there, everyone would roll out the red carpet for them? In fact, they got took because they did not spend the time to get to know people, to really build long-term relationships, whatever. Again, I think a new generation can read a book like this and say, you know something? This does matter. There's an amazing co-authorship here. Innovation is going to come from surprising places that are really going to change the world, and we're going to have to engage in it in a different way than we have been conventionally.
How do the governments in these places factor into...
So this is a very mixed bag, and it's across the spectrum. And a lot of times people will say to me, well, the governments in the Middle East are a disaster, so forget it, which is ironic, because often people out here also think the government doesn't matter. But you and I know the government does matter, right? I mean, the government matters if for no other reason that it's making a conscious decision to get out of the way can have huge ramifications. But rule of law stuff matters. I mean, it just matters to be able... for the free movement of goods, people, ideas, and money, you know, the government affects that. Whether we want it to or not, that's a part of it. So that's the first acceptance I think people, for the most part, really do understand, even if they'd like to dismiss it. I think that governments around the world, America in a different way, but around the world, are looking at what's happening and they're making decisions that could have a multiplier effect on them. I think, for example, the region that I understand very well, we should watch very closely the UAE, United Arab Emirates, because in Dubai, but not just in Dubai, government's making very proactive actions to do government 2, 3.0, whatever you want to choose, so that everything happens online. It's long been a great place for people to do business generally. They're doing rule of law things, which are quite helpful for the starting and also the failure, the quick workout of failure of businesses. That has a multiplier effect not only in that country, but I think within the region and Africa and beyond. So that matters. On the other hand, we could spend a very tragic time talking about Syria, where decisions were made of the 20th century, where it's about kleptocracy and about the top 10% protecting their own and not trusting that there are potentials in technology. And, you know, I saw some of the most marvelous and creative and artistic entrepreneurs in Damascus in 2011, and I can tell you the two of them are dead. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, this is not preordained. But this, and I say this to governments all the time, you can make a decision to play the 20th century game. Not only will you miss an opportunity that we could not have discussed in terms of ramifications of solving the very problems that you're held accountable for, I will tell you that if you sit this out for 5 years, catching up 5 years from now, I think is going to be incredibly difficult. So you lose in the short term and the long term. But people are people, and governments are governments. A lot of them are a lot older, and that doesn't mean that this is a no-brainer, it's all going to happen just because I say it's going to happen.
On the foreign policy front, some people have argued, I think Fareed Zakaria wrote a book about maybe some countries not yet being ready for democracy, like there needs to be some sort of middle step. Do you have strong thoughts on that, or do you focus more on the tech?
I'm a big fan of Fareed's, and in fact, he did a wonderful, he did one of the most thoughtful, because he knows the world, one of the most thoughtful overviews of these issues, and also my book, but overall, so I'm a great admirer of his. I guess where I come out of it is... you know, when I was in business school in the 90s, and there were three conventional wisdoms that nobody, you couldn't argue, if you try to argue, you'd get kind of mocked at a dinner party or whatever, right? And it was that Japan had won it all, that India was a basket case, there were riots going on all the time in the early mid-90s, and so it would be outside of the economic realm forever, and that China could never have economic growth without political liberalization and Jeffersonian democracy. And obviously, within 5 years of that, nobody was saying any of it. Now, I feel very, very strongly about people's ability to be free, and I think that there's a hand-in-glove thing about the ability to have great economic success brings with it the ability to have a greater exchange of ideas at a much broader level, and a freedom of movement entails not just economics, but entails kind of the human engagement. But I'm not so theological as Fareed is to say that because the democracy is not there, there cannot be the phenomenon that I'm talking about.
Right.
Because the phenomenon that I'm talking about, which you've lived and which you've built here, it's a bottom-up phenomenon anyway.
Yep.
I mean, governments can stand in its way, block it, slow it down, do a bunch of different things, but in the end, the proverbial genie is out of the bottle, and it's all happening because of ubiquitous access of technology. It's its own democracy with a small d that just is. And so I don't think this is a staging thing. I really don't. I don't agree with that.
Mark Andreessen, your friend and business partner, you're involved with Andreessen, wrote the foreword to your book.
He did.
That's a pretty good cosign. Do you, you know, as you think about the work that you want to do in the Middle East, you know, whether it's on the investing front or on the education front, or I'm just kind of inventing potential things that one, you know, could do, you know, connecting entrepreneurs. How do you evaluate the different options and think where you can make the biggest impact? What's the, you know, biggest opportunity?
So, the, you know, this is, by the way, no difference when I think about investing in American companies, for example. The conversation is not different. It's amazing to me. Out here is quite good about this. But, for example, my home is in Washington, and often I get questions like that from people in policy who are very well-minded and really thinking about it. And the question I ask them that stumps them, which gets to the essence of what you're asking, is, so if you ask anybody on the ground what they need? And they kind of look at you funny for a second, like, oh, yeah, maybe that's a good idea. So this is not, again, with a thesis of this is a very bottom-up phenomenon and not a top-down one. I think what you can really do is look where there's fundamental need. And what's been amazing to me in my travels is that there is not only parallels with what I've seen in the Middle East and Central Asia, like Turkey and Iran. This is true in Latin America, it's true in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. There are some amazingly shared needs. So let me give you two fundamental examples. There is progressively more, probably not enough, so I think Dave McClure is very smart to do what he's doing, angel financing.
Yep.
Little bit of what you and I would call A round, but in most of these markets, and the good news, much less dollars than would be a typical A round, say, in Silicon Valley. And then until you get almost a private equity, there is nothing. Mm-hmm. This goes back to how exciting our ecosystem really is when you stop and think about it, because you have this entire spectrum to get the capital you need to get to the places you want to be to build a great scalable enterprise. And you know that in this country and now in other parts of the world, great scalable enterprises kick out other scalable enterprises. You have that kind of thing. But imagine if you took your great company now and you got some angel financing, maybe a little A, but there was no B, C, and D. It simply wasn't available. What would the ramifications of that be on product and other companies like that? And that's the case in many emerging markets. So there's absolutely an opportunity, I think, to have a much broader swath of capital. Many of these cultures tend to be very risk averse. They're very asset heavy. If they had a choice of investing in a startup or investing in a hotel, they'd invest in a hotel kind of thing. But that is a gaping opportunity that young people would tell you is very important to them. The second thing is this is an incredibly autodidact phenomenon. And what I mean by that is that the young entrepreneurs are self-taught because technology allows them to see everything. I mean, I was in Iran and I was having lunch with 20 startups and half of them showed me their smartphones to show them me the Coursera courses that they're taking from Stanford and Wharton and whatever to be able to help harness themselves. But the education slash mentorship aspect of it in these relatively newer ecosystems is something that is a desperate need. And very often what ends up happening is when they do find investment, there is what I call term sheet abuse, where people, there's not a lot of competition, so the investors can set ridiculous terms.
Right.
If people come in and help them raise money at smart, encouraging, incentivizing terms, and then they're there to offer that mentorship and connection and more formality in some of the education and building bridges to things that YC is doing here and Dave is doing here, I mean, these are two really very crystal clear needs which people talk about. I mean, obviously, everyone will talk about anything in the rule of law that allows the freer movement of goods and services and ideas is very important. But from an externality to your question, those are two things which I know if you were to interview almost anyone on the street, they would say that.
Do you see a trend? You were mentioning some people with money are risk averse. Do you see the young entrepreneurs as being risk averse? And are there ways to kind of teach that?
It's an incredibly wonderful question, and because it's very important. And the answer is that at one level, you do assume that the new generation that comes up and makes its first money is going to churn it back in. Mm-hmm. So the guy, a wonderful man I write about in my book named Sami Tukan, was the founder of what was effectively the Yahoo of the Middle East that was called Maktub. Maktub got bought by Yahoo for $160, $170 million. And the first thing that two things happened. Sami, some of the entrepreneurs within that company split off and took some of the assets, which Yahoo did not take, and built companies out of them. So, for example, the Amazon of the Middle East is a company called Souq.com, which was a spinoff of Maktub, which is now just valued over $1 billion.
Wow.
So there's that flywheel. Yeah. One of the first things Sami did when he won, you know, when he sold Maktub, he's now an angel investor. And in fact, A round investor as well. So that flywheel that, you know, they call out here the PayPal effect or whatever is absolutely in process. And absolutely, if you're under 40, you look at this differently. Having said that, success just breeds success.
Yeah.
And you look at these, in my view, they're heroes. It's Fadi Gondour throughout the Middle East who built an amazing enterprise called Aramex, which is effectively the FedEx of the Middle East. He's now investing in companies all over the place. He's in his 50s. Another hero is a guy named Ahmed Alfi in Egypt, who's built the first system of incubators, not only in Egypt, but around the Middle East. You know, he's all in. He's in his 50s. And as people see success, people want to get, you know, money, yeah. money tends to want to go to where there is success. So the flywheel, I think, will be pushed with velocity by people younger, but I think it's going to become quite universal with that success.
And I'm curious, for someone who's been doing, you know, who's been doing it as long as you have, who's had their own successes, you could be kind of, you know, relaxing, but you're traveling all over the world, you know, you're building these things. What's motivated you to keep on pushing on?
I'm the luckiest, I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. Yeah. I could take another cavalierly, but I'm the luckiest man alive. And frankly, you and I are the luckiest. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be born and living now and to be thinking about these problems in 2015 and frankly, from a base of the United States.
Yeah.
It's literally the greatest time to be alive in world history, and why anyone in any stage would ever want to sit down or look at it at the margins or think that it's a bad time is baffling to me. I think the corollary to that is I'm really curious. I mean, yeah. I want to see how this shit plays out. Mm-hmm. I just go out there and I'm like, wow, that's that kind of thing.
And say more about the best time in world history. So what, you know, best time to build a business, to build a tech, say more about this.
First of all, I mean, there's a lot of conventional wisdom, and particularly I think if you read a traditional media group like New York Times or whatever, like the world's going to hell in a handbag. But if you actually look deeper into the sections or if you see what people are doing out there, the amount of bottom-up solutions that people are finding innovatively, even through fancy technology or even lesser technology, is just unbelievable because it's there. Right? I mean, one thing that's always been true is that no one has a better stake in solving the problems than the people who it's the yeah. problem is in their backyard. The problem is very often there was not enough capital or there were no tools with which people could go at it. Now, as I said before, not only do they have the tools, but all of a sudden they've got access to the best practices. They have, Mark wrote this in my forward, I mean, they have access to essentially all of human knowledge essentially for free. And so that ability has us to look at things and say, this is not just an unmitigated disaster. Things can happen right now because they can, in fact, that they are. I think sometimes in America, and it's a blessing of ours in a way, and it's a cool thing about us in a way, but there's a cautionary to it. We tend to think of innovation as the bright, shiny new thing. And let me tell you something. If you were in Kenya 10 years ago and you didn't have access to a bank or cash, but you did have access to a dumb phone, not even a smartphone, yeah. and all of a sudden a service is offered where you can move cash through texting, that's like that would, M-Pesa is the name of the company. And over two-thirds of people in Kenya use it on a regular basis every day yeah. to move cash around the country. M-Pesa is not innovative in mobile payments the way some of the things you and I see out here are, quote, you know, bright, shiny new things. Try telling somebody in Kenya that's not innovation. And that's the kind of stuff throughout an entire spectrum. If you don't get hung up on definitions, you know, you have an ability just to do things which I think very, very powerful. The risk, it almost goes back to the earliest part of this conversation. The risk lies in narrative bias, right? When people say, it's wonderful sometimes just to listen to people like Elon Musk, it because it's fascinating when you say, well, look at the trajectory of what's happening with the environment. Incredibly bad, incredibly serious, must be addressed, must be thought at. But on the other hand, if you think that the world is going to be a place like it is today in 10 years, then you're right, it's going to be a disaster. If all of a sudden you think, you know, driverless cars might work, then you start saying to yourself, oh my God, you know, half of the power plants will go away.
Right.
And you just have to, it's a mindset thinking. And unlike fantasizing about stuff, say 50 years ago or 100 years ago, it's actually all there.
Yeah.
And most of it works. This is the best time to be alive.
You know, it's really interesting to say this. Before San Francisco, I spent a few years in Detroit. And, you know, I would always bring up the argument that, like, you know, what you just said, all human, you know, history is available for free. Basically, you can teach yourself anything. There's all these tools at hand, and yet I would get responses back, not just in Detroit, all over, that, you know, that's true, but social mobility is less than it used to be, or income inequality is even greater, or, you know, they would say the American dream is dead. Like, the tools are there, but so one is that fact just incorrect? Or two, is it something beyond just the tools being there, but sort of cultural? I don't know, what holds people back then?
Look, first of all, I think it's a very important question. It's not one to be dismissed. I think the idea that America's greatest days are over, I think, is pablum for political campaigns and has absolutely no bearing on what potential may be. This is not to say that we do not have problems of obesity. This does not mean that we don't have problems that often happen in successful societies who take it for granted. It doesn't mean that we're not making mistakes in global politics. I mean, there are thousands. Look, there are thousands of mistakes, right? Mm. And there are thousands of probably a million problems. But that's what makes us exciting, because that means there's work for us to do. And look, I got to tell you, I do think some of it's generational. I'm talking as a guy in the 40s or whatever, right? But I really do think that there are people my age and older who really look at the world, and this is almost a neurological, scientifically proven thing. They look at the next 20 years like the last 20 years, and they take the Cold War as a premise of world engagement because it's a familiar analogy, and they look at the thing around them, and they don't quite understand it anymore, and they're sad that Walter Cronkite isn't the one person telling us what to think of the news anymore, and it's just part of a DNA kind of a thing. And I think even in Detroit, I mean, obviously with great poverty, but I've spent a lot of time with the entrepreneurs in Detroit, and there's some really interesting things happening there. They're locked and loaded. I mean, they're locked and loaded. May not work. These other things are very troublesome. Not everyone has access to the technology or is given the same view or lens of hopefulness that you and I take for granted now. These are all very serious issues. And so I don't dismiss that. It's not unimportant, but I think that it's it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm.
Kevin Kelly recently said that when someone asked him, you know, he said that we need a new mythology that is consistent with the advancement, the rapid rate of change of technology and the actualization of human experience. Like, how do people even process, you know, let alone driverless cars, but artificial intelligence and, you know, virtual reality, and how do they make sense of?
And this is, I mean, look, there's absolutely a staging thing here. And, you know, you have some sense, I'm a pretty hopeful guy. Mm-hmm. And so, whatever it is, sometimes I'll talk to our sisters and brothers out here. And one in particular recently was saying artificial intelligence really is, in fact, about to become something quite scary. And when I said, what do you think is the best thing we do? So, you know, we should keep in mind that government sometimes is necessary and regulation is sometimes necessary. They should be stepping in on this. And I thought, I live in Washington and I talk to a lot of people, a lot of different things. Let me tell you, just outside of DARPA, I don't think there are a lot of people talking about artificial intelligence in Washington. So that made me a little bit, you know, kind of nervous of where it can go. And the ramifications of you know, a Werner Vinge world where we really have such incredible Oculus-like capabilities where we can create other realities, no question is going to open up conversations. And like most, like technology through history, it is a two-edged sword. The airplane, you know, do you think that Orville and Wilbur thought someone would fly a plane into the World Trade Center? And do you think that if we described an iPad now in 1925, people would not be worried about what its ramifications might be? I mean, look, as Andrew McAfee and others argue, it's moving much faster and much bigger, and the societal ramifications of that are not to be poo-pooed. But I just come out more hopeful than I do, and we tend to work through what those challenges are.
Being in tech, but also being in DC, you sit at a very interesting perch in that you see both policy and politics and technology. What does Silicon Valley not get about Washington, D.C., and what does Washington, D.C. not get about Silicon Valley and tech hubs?
So it's the best of the best really have a very keen understanding. They may not know the mechanics and how it works, but an appreciation and respect. There's a reason why talent like DJ Patil is now in Washington, right? And this is a very serious data guy. And I commend, without any partisanship one way or the other, I wish sooner, but I commend the last 2 years what the president has done and sort of bringing some of that here and whatever. You know, they speak different. The thing to remember is that people speak very different languages and presumptions are very different. This is a silly example, but to give you a sense of it. I wrote a paper not long ago for a think tank, and I wanted to pull together some analysis for everything else. And the very well-intended young researcher like sent me all these research reports in 2013 from 2003. And in Washington, you know, if you pull up really good World Bank data from 2003, it might be relevant in a lot of issues. Totally irrelevant to anything. I mean, 2003 is five lifetimes ago in the world you or I in. So some of it's just like a mindset, kind of a different kind of language that people need to understand, that language needs to be spoken. And that government is not business. I mean, these are very different things. I do think at the same time, however, there's a profound, not only narrative bias in Washington about the way the world can be, particularly if you've been there for 20 years or more, but I think people out here underestimate what a machine it is. In other words, there is a really big incentive in lobbying dollars and lobbying infrastructure for business as usual. Like blowing up things or disrupting things in the name of greater efficiency is not necessarily the thing which is viewed ideally by the, you know, the Eisenhower talked about the military-industrial complex, where so much money is going to be put in by big businesses and military and whatever, that that could be a check. I actually think that we have a lobbying lack of intelligence complex that actually is very hard for people out here to understand and is very real day to day in terms of getting things done within a place like Washington.
You're so optimistic about tech. There's a lot of cynicism towards politics and towards government. You know, based on everything you see, is that warranted?
Well, I mean, it's like here, the slowness and the narrative bias is there. The amount of money that goes into getting somebody elected and what you have to do to serve in public office, you and I would not want to go through the vetting. I mean, I think we're both good human beings, but it's just a miserable, costly vetting. And I know very good people who've gotten chewed up in the system for political reasons. If you run for the House of Representatives, you're not spending a lot of time with your colleagues getting to know each other. You're spending an unbelievable amount of time fundraising. I mean, this kind of mechanisms are very problematic and concern me actually greatly. I think there's a reason why voter turnout is as low as it is, even by historical standards, because I think people think we can solve problems elsewhere. And that's not necessarily good, because then wings and factions tend to keep coming. Now, having said that, I think there's really cool stuff happening at the municipal level. Mm-hmm. I think lots of stuff happening at the county level, even at the state level. And so to write it off and say it's all fucked up, to me, I think is irresponsible. And so it's like everything in life. It's a balancing with an understanding that things can be pushed so far, but democratic processes by definition are deliberative and take time.
And on the highest level, with the biggest reformations that you recommend be on the lobbying front or on the financing front, or are there other big things that you'd want to...
From a federal government, national thing?
Yeah.
People disagree with me on this very passionately and think that the Supreme Court decision of Citizens United wasn't that big of a deal. I think money is an unbelievable corrupting force in terms of the substance of dialogue and in terms of where people spend their time and thinking about the issues that you and I have talked about overall. It's funny because a friend of mine has said, I don't care how much money people invest, at the end of the day, voters will vote how they'll vote. They really will. It's hard to prove that giving this person $1 million. I'm not convinced that that's true. As you know, 90% plus people tend to get reelected, and they tend to get reelected because they tend to get a lot of money. But back to what I said before, it's not just money in politics, but it's money in governance. And in the regulatory environments, I mean, the really smart lobbyists are spending, I mean, the whole, it's actually a victory in a way that we'll see if it's a Pyrrhic victory or not, but the whole net neutrality thing was all about big guys spending a lot of big money in Washington, not in the politicians, but in Washington, to capture people's attention. And I actually think that's one of the most important things.
Yeah. This 2016 stuff is crazy. You know, like Donald Trump is everywhere in my newsfeed, people talking about it, and it's almost seems like a resurgence in an interest in politics, but not because of actual politics, but because of the sideshow, you know, or politics as sports.
So we could have an entirely long time. I mean, frankly, you and I should go out and have a scotch on this subject alone. And all, but look, we're living. I love that we have all the world's knowledge at our fingertips. It is a reality, and I saw this as early as when I ran WashingtonPost.com and Newsweek.com. These tools also allow us to do very dangerous things. They allow us to surround ourselves with people who agree with us. I mean, I used to think the most beautiful thing on life is going to be that I'm going to have to hear your views whether I like it or not, and we're going to have to push each other. And in reality, people tend to go to self-confirming environments within the use of technology, which to me is very problematic, because it then allows us to demonize the other side of the problems that you and I know. Secondly, is what I call kind of a hashtag ADD world of policy, which is that you get very excited by the entertainmentization as much as on the subs of the issues, and then, by the way, you lose interest in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is not good for civic society. I think Trump is hit on issues and anger, certainly of a certain demographic here. But I actually put a lot of blame on the media and others who just love to feed that fire because, frankly, he's really entertaining.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is fine. It's always been true. Politics has always had a P.T. Barnum aspect to it. But we're in pretty serious and important times. And it would be lovely to see a little bit more of the other as part of the engagement. But, you know, it's not like the information's not out there. We as citizens have to decide that we want to find it.
Right. Alain de Botton, British writer, just came out with an article describing what he thinks the utopian news would look like. It's amazing, and, you know, given your experience in journalism, you know, what are some of the things that most worry you, or the biggest reformations you would have in terms of how journalism works?
I'm now almost feeling like in this talk I'm kind of a naive guy, because I'm actually hopeful even about the future. I think this is a golden opportunity for journalism. People like to summarily reject BuzzFeed as a clickbait thing, but the fact is that even in my days, you know, the Washington Post newspaper was driven largely in ways that people did not like to admit, by people who like sports, they like comics, they liked coupons. I mean, so there's the business model aspect and the journalistic part of this. And what thrills me about BuzzFeed and other enterprises, Vox for sure, is that they do clever things to aggregate audience. They do things because advertisers still require them as part of the business model, but it's allowed them to fund some amazing storytelling, Vice too. I mean, it's a soft porn site half the time, and they've done some amazingly gutsy journalism on the ground. And these enterprises, by the way, are all coming in at a fraction of the cost of the structure of traditional people. So from a structural basis, I think there's a lot of stuff out there that could be pretty important, pretty impactful. There's a lot out there. There's a tremendous amount of cacophony. People do tend to gravitate to their own areas, and you know, these are, in my view, opportunities.
Yeah. It's refreshing that you're so optimistic about these things, because I've been so dystopian recently. You know, I just read The Circle. I was watching Black Mirror. Yeah. I had less dystopian and more just perhaps, you know, I'm still going full steam ahead, and I do think it's the best time, but afraid that we're going too fast to even understand, you know, some of the ramifications of some of the things we're building.
And the speed is unprecedented. I mean, like I've had this conversation with Andy McAfee, who's a hero to me. I think he's one of the great thinkers, because I pointed out to him that in the 1920s and 1930s, there was this amazing guy who built like those future societies for the world's fairs. And, you know, they were like flying cars and stuff that didn't happen, but a lot, like television and other stuff, were all there. And a lot of people at the time said, this is going to kill jobs. They saw a lot of robotics, and they said jobs are going to be blown out. Now, we have, the numbers are loaded, but pick your favorite number. We have somewhere between 5 and 7% unemployment today. Mm-hmm. Anyone who went to the World's Fair in the late 30s would have killed to have the unemployment then that we have today. So my argument has been, we tend to find, you know, economy shift, new things happen, opportunities open up that we can't even predict. Right, those who were great fighters for the agrarian society could not envision the economic ramifications of that evolution.
The gap between the haves and the have-nots, is that rising? Is income inequality overrated as an issue?
I don't think it's overrated as an issue. I mean, there's the academic data-driven aspect of this, which shows that if you look at not only levels of poverty, but potential movement between now and even when I was a child, it's like night and day. Vox did a wonderful series of slides comparing how we are today and a lot of these factors that people tend to get worried about or upset about, and put it in a context. And I think that's, you know, interesting, and it does show a trajectory of something that is, again, very, very hopeful. Look, we live in a period where there's tremendous asymmetry, and a very small group of people can hurt a lot of other people, and a lot of that hurt comes from sociological things, but a lot of it happens because of this kind of a sense of injustice and a hubris that come from it. And I do think we should be very worried and taking very seriously the kind of separation that you're seeing right now, keeping in mind at the same time that more people are reading than ever before. The relative averages of what people are living on is much better than it is before. We just have to look at each other at the same time and say, okay, if it was $1 a year and now it's $2 a year, is that good enough? Is that what we want to be? And of course, one, I think no. Two, I think the disparagement can cause unintended consequences, which are very bad. But three, we now have tools we've never had before to go after these things.
You're so optimistic about so many things. What's the biggest thing that you haven't yet mentioned that really worries you?
Well, I mean, friends of mine who know me get tired of me saying this because I say it often, because people do call me an optimist, and perhaps in many ways that I am. But there was a really kind of a hero of mine when I was a kid. Not a hero, but I admired him greatly. He was the first president of Czechoslovakia after the wall fell, Václav Havel. And he makes this wonderful distinction between optimism and hope. And optimism is effectively everything's going to work out. Tomorrow's going to be a beautiful day, pen glossy, and everything's going to work out. Hope is, you know, sometimes stuff doesn't work out, but it made sense. And I'm more of a hopeful man, actually, than I am, I think, an optimistic man. Because, look, I'm intrigued by space travel, not because it's cool, though it is cool, but because I do agree that at some point we have population issues here and resource issues here that can be addressed by these new opportunities and, in fact, may require them overall. The environment things that you talked about, I think, are absolutely very serious. What will happen when AE moves to where we all know that it will move? You know, I watch these things with caution. Mm-hmm. The asymmetry of these challenges, because if we know anything from history, often big things have very small beginnings. All that stuff I keep a cautious eye to and take very, very seriously with great respect and I hope a little bit of humility. And yet I say to myself, okay, those are all there. And now I've got tools that you and I literally could not have a discussion 5 years ago and talk about 80% of the tools that are available to us now. And I tend to spend most of my time focusing on those.
If you were, let's say in 2015, given your interest in talents and skill sets, if you were 18 years old today, would you go to college? What would you do?
As I have a son who is into college but is about to take a gap year, it's actually a very realistic kind of a circumstance. And overall, there are a lot of different reasons that a college education can be the right thing for the right person who just looks at it as an opportunity not to get a credential but to milk this rare opportunity to be around a lot of very smart people and to expose themselves to seeing the world and everything else. The construct and the costs and all these kinds of things are just so begging for disruption that I think that in 2015 we'll be talking about a different dynamic. But to me, like most things in life, it has a lot to do with fit, and it has a lot to do with where you can most actualize. Do I think it's a necessity or requirement to build a great company? By definition, not. Some of the best companies you and I know about were created by people who dropped out of college, obviously, and so on. But the idea that college will be in 10 years or 20 years, you know, what it is today, I think, you know, it's yet an opportunity to think about it, not as this way that parents want to feel good because their kid got into Columbia, but that there's actually a pedagogical methodology of preparation for the 21st century and the things that we're talking about, I think are going to be very exciting.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a lot less about physical classrooms, though I still think there'll be physicality to it, and a lot more about the early days of things that we're seeing in technology now. To me, the bigger question is, are you prepared to take on these issues? And there are going to be a lot of different ways to prepare to take on these issues, and it shouldn't be prescribed just to a simple structural paradigm, because that's the way it's been for 500 years.
And especially when you talk to entrepreneurs in the Middle East who are young and college age, are you saying that they're just kind of building outside the system, or are they building within the system?
Like everything in life, and not dissimilar here. You know, similarities in discussions that I have, it's unbelievable. In fact, my son, he was just did an internship in a startup in Taiwan, and he just came back from it, and I had dinner with him and just was drilling him on it generally and asking him in particular, like, what are all the differences? And he would talk about differences, but at the end of it, he finally turned to me and said, Dad, you have to understand, the biggest surprise that I have in these experiences you've helped me do is that there aren't differences.
Like, yeah.
And this, to me, is a type of thing. So it's like everything else. I meet young people there who give their left leg to come to MIT, and other people say, I wish we had an MIT here, but of our own nature, not MIT getting paid to have a lot of money here, but to actually have something of our society, of our culture, of our history, of our language there. And other people say, fuck it, I don't care about any of that stuff. I can get it all online. I'm going to go build my company.
Yeah.
It's not dissimilar to what I think we would find here.
And going back to you for a second, if you, let's say you had gone to a great college and you were 23 and you had your whole kind of life ahead of you, what would you do first? What would you build first?
I have to tell you, I mean, there are so many things that I'm curious about, so many things that are interesting. And if I had a proclivity towards really hard engineering, AI would be something that's very interesting. We haven't talked about it at all here, and I think the ramifications of it, particularly in emerging markets, is going to be significant. I think we are in the earliest days of understanding the blockchain. And not only is a way of moving what we used to call currency, but actually moving any data and sharing in a trusted, safe environment. I think we could be revolutionizing IP. I think we can revolutionize media and music. I think we're in the earliest days of something that are going to have huge ramifications, particularly in underbanked societies that have difficulty in finding and connecting with different kinds of communication. I have to tell you, that would be one area that if I were coming right out of school or right out of high school, I'd be spending a lot more time on.
In 5 years, when we're having the same conversation, how are we going to be talking about these emerging markets that you're studying?
Oh, I think one thing is like the sun setting in the West, and that is there'll be 70%+ of people walking around with smart devices across all of them. I can't tell you, I say this before, but I can't tell you what Syria will look like in a year, Egypt will look like, whether it'll pull things out smartly in 5 years, but you and I could sit here and say that 5 years from now, 7 years from now, whatever, 2/3 or more of humanity will have supercomputers of some form on their person and will be using them. So that, to me, is like the sun setting in the West. In terms of who succeeds and who wins in developing and supporting the kinds of things we talked about, I think the jury is still out. And again, as I phrase this to other people, it's a choice. Like, you know, people are going to be making choices. The other thing that I underscore to folks is this is the most mobile society in the history of women and mankind. And by this, I don't mean devices at all. I mean talent can go to where talent can succeed. And so I will turn to one country in the Middle East and say, I assure you, if you don't open up an environment that allows for this, they will go to Dubai. And if things don't work out in Dubai, they are going to figure out a way to come to somewhere in India or somewhere in the United States or whatever, because talent is mobile. And the last observation I would make, which is probably pretty close to the sun setting in the West with, you know, a plague taking me away or anything else, but just generally speaking, the rise of middle class and the rise of the role of these economies that we still think of as a distant thing in terms of its not only power in a global sense, but a power in and of itself. As the great founder of Endeavor, Linda Rotenberg, says, emerging market to emerging market. First of all, I don't think we're going to be calling them emerging markets anymore. And I think their ramification, not only vis-a-vis us, but the strength and power among them is going to be very profound in that period.
Yeah. And charter cities, is that going to be a thing? Should that be a thing?
I don't, you know, it's not an area that I'm, you know, it's as expansive on. So a couple of things that I've, you know, discounted, but just as an observation I have. The idea that, that also I probably could have added it to your previous question, that 70%+ of humanity will be living in some kind of urban setting, I also think is becoming quite clear as well with the ramifications all across the spectrum of that. I think typically there's a lot of argument that there will be the mega city or several mega cities. I think one of the things that's interesting to watch in China and elsewhere is that there are just going to be multiple cities. That the idea that there's going to be one hub and that's going to define a country or a region is not going to be necessarily irrelevant. I think Singapore is very important in Southeast Asia. And I think Dubai is and UAE generally will be very important to the Arab world and even parts of Africa. But that in no way means that Amman will not be an incredible city if it makes this choice. And look, I think Cairo could be one of the great cities on the planet. That needs a lot of work and a lot of things that it has to wrestle. But the size and scale and talent there is really quite important. So that doesn't mean that there's one mega city, but in fact there could be.
Yeah.
It should be, will be many.
You know, we mentioned this just briefly, but, you know, it's so exciting, especially some of the work. We initially met because of the, you know, I saw on Twitter that you were doing some work in Gaza.
Yeah.
And, you know, me being half Israeli, I'm super interested in that. And when I go later this year, it's definitely something I want to check out because it's not something I'd heard of before. And then, you know, reading more of your work. So awesome. The book is Startup Rising. Where can people learn more about you and your work? And it online.
So the book is on Amazon, yep. as you can imagine, and all the obvious places like that. www.startuprisingbook.com not only has a lot of background and coverage about the book, but about the issues. It's a very substantive site, it tells a little bit more about me. I'm an influencer on LinkedIn, and so I write about some of these issues regularly there as well.
Cool. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here.